This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. President Donald Trump threatened to escalate tensions with North Korea on Friday morning, wrapping up several days of hysteria over the possibility of a nuclear war. Following up on his earlier comments where he promised to unleash, quote, fire and fury on North Korea, he responded on Friday saying perhaps he didn't go far enough. He also tweeted, quote, military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded. Should North Korea act wisely, hopefully Kim Jong-un will find another path. While most analysts say there is nothing to worry about, but given the instability and unpredictability of Mr. Trump, there may be plenty of concern. My guest is Rahul Mahajan. He is the author of two books, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, as well as The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He's a PhD student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin, and he's also the U.S. foreign policy and empire correspondent for this show. Welcome back, Rahul.
Great to be with you again, Sonali.
So first, we did cover with a North Korea expert the comments that Trump made that began this whole this whole war of words, if you will. What do you make of what he said on Friday? He seems to like these alliterative phrases, if you will. Fire and fury was the first one. Locked and loaded is the second one. I don't know if he's watching a lot of Hollywood films, but should this just be dismissed as bluster?
Well, so we have a showdown between an unstable autocrat with a nuclear arsenal and a penchant for a fiery rhetoric who owes his position to his father and Kim Jong-un. So it's a volatile situation, primarily because Trump doesn't seem to understand that the game is a game of rhetorical chicken, and he's playing against somebody who's basically his entire strategy is to throw away the steering wheel, in the words of Thomas Schelling, talking about chicken. So Kim Jong-un is continuing in a tradition with the North Korean regime of basically justifying its existence in that form to its people by saying that it's there to protect them against a brutal and corrupting world, and that it has tremendous power, which it constantly shows by making threats against other countries and getting them to either back down or make concessions. Given that that's the sort of basis for the stability and legitimacy of the North Korean regime, Trump is getting himself into a war of words that he can't possibly win.
Right. I mean, if he refuses to back down and Kim Jong-un refuses to back down, at some point, one of them is going to call the other's bluff. And then what, we're in full-scale war?
Well, so North Korea is certainly engaged in the occasional belligerent act. Certainly, I mean, back in the day, kidnapping Japanese actresses, and there are all these allegations about counterfeiting U.S. currency. But North Korea is not going to war with anyone. It hasn't. Even though its current testing of missiles is seen as highly provocative by the United States, it's all in the context of a paranoid regime, which in a way has a lot to be paranoid about. It has never really recovered psychologically, in a sense, from the Korean War, and the worldview that is put out. It's not one that's believed by people like Kim Jong-un, but the worldview that is put out in the country is very much one of the United States is ready to unleash incredible destruction on North Korea like it did during the Korean War, and we have to be extremely strong and tough in order to constantly keep it at bay. So in a way, he can't back down. In another way, there's no real reason to believe that he's thinking about this in terms of aggression rather than in terms of deterring aggression from others.
Now, the U.S. territory of Guam is, I believe, geographically the most convenient place for North Korea to threaten. And already, authorities on the island have issued fact sheets to residents, telling them, quote, "Do not look at the flash or the fireball of any missile. It can blind you. Lie flat on the ground. Cover your head." Guam is basically in the position that here in the United States, Americans were in the during the Cold War, it seems.
Well, yes, I can't imagine that they're very happy about being on the front line right now, even if it is really a rhetorical front line. But again, it's not as if there's any clear reason to believe that North Korea even has the capacity to attack Guam. And if it did, in fact, if we knew it had that capacity, then the situation would be more stable, not less so. And even Trump might realize that he couldn't actually have anything to gain by constantly escalating the rhetoric and the various kinds of seemingly aggressive maneuvers. So right now, I think that, again, people really need to think about this from the point of view of the North Korean regime. I mean, actually, Kim Jong-un is probably a fairly rational person himself, but the regime has been committed to a fundamentally, in a way, deeply irrational approach to maintaining its own stability, to telling North Koreans a story about how the entire rest of the world is this horrible, corrupting, and sometimes incredibly violent influence. And you have to understand all of what's going on in that context, in the context of how the regime legitimates its own existence.
Now, there is also, of course, the question of how capable North Korea is. On the one hand, even a non-nuclear missile could trigger nuclear war from the US, but does North Korea have the capability of actually lobbing a nuclear-tipped missile to the US? How nuclear a state is North Korea?
Well, that is a matter of a lot of controversy among military strategists.
Right.
And I'm pretty certain that key people in the Trump administration were actually earlier on convincing themselves with rather rosy scenarios that suggested not only that North Korea had no capability to deliver a nuclear warhead, but also that its much vaunted massing of conventional artillery could be so quickly neutralized in a war that casualties in Seoul could be kept to within a few thousand people. So that actually was a very dangerous kind of analysis. It's been put forth in some strategic journals over the past 5 or 6 years by various people. And I think that a lot of people at the Trump administration had bought into it. And that's why early on they were committing themselves to this notion that we're going to make North Korea back down from something, but we're not going to do it through negotiation or through offering them anything the way that Clinton did for a while with the agreed framework back in the 1990s. Now, I think in the light of the most recent test, they are drastically revising that. And I think perhaps some of them are surprised and upset about the possibility that North Korea may actually have that capability. And again, if they actually do, and if they can demonstrate it without actually engaging in acts of war, I think that it will mean that our own administration, with its despotic mad king in charge, is going to have to think better of continuing to escalate the crisis.
Rahul, the broader framework of all of this is that Trump has been struggling for more than for about 8 months now to have some kind of a win. He's angry with his own party over the failure to pass healthcare reform and overturn Obamacare. His Muslim ban has had several legal setbacks. However, presidents know that when they have some kind of a military adventure, when they threaten another state, they can cement public opinion behind them on the home front. How much of that you think might be playing into this? Or because of his belligerence with North Korea, is he likely to lose support even over a foreign policy issue?
So I'm sure that there is some element of calculation of getting public support behind him. If there's one thing that Trump understands, it's ratings. But, you know, I think frankly that Trump is actually the kind of person that Kim Jong-un or his father before him is trying to represent himself to be, a guy who will descend into unreasoning belligerence at the drop of a hat and can't be backed down once he does that. I mean, that's the way North Korea has tried to present itself to the world in order to, as I said, not just shore up its own regime, but occasionally actually perhaps win certain arrangements or concessions without appearing to their own people to be backing down. But Trump is, that's actually the way he thinks of thinking is really the right word to use. So I think a lot of it is spontaneous. I think that he got annoyed, and he thinks that it's cool and tough to say cool and tough things, and to use, as you said, alliterative phrases. I mean, if you strip out all the verbiage, what he's actually said is pretty much what presidents usually at least hint or indicate when they're dealing with North Korea. If they go beyond a certain point, we will do this, and they know that they can't possibly stand what military might will unleash on them. So it's not that much different in actual content, but of course, it's the rhetorical style that is going to inflame the crisis further.
In fact, we've queued up the video of Trump addressing reporters where he just dug his heels in on North Korea. Here's a video of Trump speaking on Friday about his statements, doubling down in a way on his statements earlier in the week.
North Koreans said yesterday that your statement on Tuesday was nonsense. That's the word that they used. Do you have any response to that?
Well, I don't think they mean that, and I think it's the first time they've heard it like they heard it. And frankly, the people that were questioning that statement, was it too tough? Maybe it wasn't tough enough. They've been doing this to our country for a long time, for many years. And it's about time that somebody stuck up for the people of this country and for the people of other countries. So, if anything, maybe that statement wasn't tough enough. And we're backed by 100% by our military. We're backed by everybody. And we're backed by many other leaders. And I noticed that many senators and others today came out very much in favor of what I said. But if anything, that statement may not be tough enough.
What would be tougher than fire and fury?
Well, you'll see. You'll see.
Mr. President, is one of the options being considered a preemptive strike, a war strike?
We don't talk about that. I never do. I'm not like the other administration that would say we're going into Mosul in 4 months. I don't talk about it. We'll see what happens. But I can tell you that what they've been doing and what they've been getting away with is a tragedy, and it can't be allowed.
Mr. President, would you ever consider negotiations under different circumstances?
Sure. We'll always consider negotiations, but they've been negotiating now for 25 years. Look at Clinton. He folded on the negotiations. He was weak and ineffective. You look what happened with Bush. You look what happened with Obama. Obama, he didn't even want to talk about it. But I talk. It's about time. Somebody has to do it.
And that is Donald Trump speaking to reporters on Friday. Rahul, one of the things that jumped out at me about his statements was this characterization of North Korea as the aggressor and the U.S. as the victim. And it just reminds me of the same kinds of sort of white nationalism and reactionary rhetoric we've seen here in the United States, nativism. So he basically said, they've been doing this to our country for a long time. It's about time someone stuck up for the people of this country. I mean, what is your comment on that? The U.S. is far more powerful than North Korea and seems to have been much more threatening towards North Korea than the other way around.
Well, I think there are two things that are probably worth disentangling. One of them is, of course, as you say, the fact that Trump perpetuates a very specific kind of victimology. I mean, remember him talking about pulling out of the Paris Accords because of all of the horrible constraints they impose on the United States without apparently realizing that every country's statement for the Paris Accords was completely voluntary and determined by that country and independent of other considerations, and there was no element of it that was binding. So the idea that we're constantly being victimized, whether it's by Chinese companies selling things to us or us entering into voluntary agreements that are non-binding with other countries, or North Korea saying a few words which make for screaming headlines but don't in any other way affect Americans. Trump really specializes in that. But there's also the fact that in general, I think you still have the remnants of the old sort of very standard foreign policy view, establishment view, if you will, that the United States was somehow some kind of special moral force during the Cold War, that when we went in and destroyed other countries, we were the victims. I mean, people still talk, when they talk about Vietnam, it's overwhelmingly about American victimology, and that's true pretty much across the legitimate political spectrum, certainly not limited to people like Trump. And Korea, in a way, even more so, because there was at some time an acknowledgement of the immorality of at least some aspects of the Vietnam War. But in terms of Korea, there's been virtually none to this day, even though the destruction that was visited on North Korea, including major North Korean cities, was actually a significant degree greater certainly than what was done in North Vietnam. So there's never been any kind of moral reckoning about that. And what's basically the rhetoric is that when you look at the nature of the North Korean regime, that somehow justifies the incredible devastation the United States wrecked on North Korea in the Korean War, when in fact, that kind of inverts the causal arrow, and it's the devastation that they inflicted on them that has a lot to do with the nature of the regime that has continued since then.
And then, Rahul, you are at the Netroots Nation conference right now. That's where you're talking to us from. Do these discussions of foreign policy make it into the activism, in particular the sort of resurgence of progressive activism that we've seen since this year, since Trump's election? There's so much, of course, so many issues to tackle, from healthcare to all of the other sort of economic inequality issues that are domestic issues. But does foreign policy enter into the conversations that you can see?
Well, so definitely in terms of the structured content, there's very little of it. There's actually a panel later on the day on the an emerging progressive foreign policy. I expect it to be tremendously like, say, what Clinton's foreign policy would be. Don't even know if I am interested in going to it. But in general, no, it simply doesn't come in. And when people do evoke the military or foreign policy, they do it in ways that used to be mostly the province of the Republican Party. And I don't think that's going to change. And I think that even Bernie Sanders, although he certainly wasn't hawkish, really usually ducked this issue. I mean, what did he say about ISIS? Oh, we will end them. How? I mean, so it's not as if even on the progressive side of the resurgent activism, there is very much new that is being said about foreign policy. That's for sure. And I don't expect that to change.
Well, Rahul, I want to thank you so much for joining us as always, and enjoy your weekend.
Thanks for having me.
My guest is Rahul Mahajan. He's the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He's also a PhD student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin and the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire correspondent for this program. We've been discussing Donald Trump's repeated threats to North Korea. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.